Welcome to the February 17th service of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Blacksburg, Virginia. The service today is led by our settled minister, Reverend Pam Phillips, and the title of her sermon is Broken Trust. The podcast begins with a reading read by Worship Associate Jim Kern.
Your order of service says the reading is from James Baldwin, and it is. But it's within the context of an article from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette written by Toni Norman. And I'm using it in that context because it sets the stage and really frames the quote nicely. The article is a 2017 review of Raoul Peck's Oscar-nominated James Baldwin documentary, I Am Not Your Negro. And the author is highlighting a particular interview in that documentary of James Baldwin. And you should really get a look at this interview on YouTube or get the documentary and watch, because it's really worth seeing. In a 1968 episode of The Dick Cavett Show, James Baldwin, who told the host earlier that he wasn't feeling too optimistic about American race relations at that particular moment, had nonetheless spoken eloquently of the toll racism takes on not only individuals, but on American democracy. Because it was the Dick Cavett Show, it was inevitable that a philosophy professor would wander onto the set to give his very learned take on James Baldwin's blues. Asked by the host if he took issue with what Baldwin had to say, Yale philosophy professor Paul Weiss said he agreed with much of Baldwin's analysis, but he said he also disagreed with a great deal of it. "But I think he's overlooking one very important matter," the professor said to Mr. Cavett, without directly addressing the author, who sat inches away from him on the couch smoking a cigarette. "Each of us, I think, is terribly alone." The philosophy professor then launched into an existentialist boilerplate about how each individual has to struggle with some obstacle in life, and that emphasizing one element of that struggle at the expense of others leads to a form of inauthenticity. "So why must we always concentrate on color?" Professor Weiss asked the author. Visibly bored with the gross paternalism behind the question, Baldwin patiently explained why he decamped to Paris in 1948 to escape America's particular social terror, which was not the paranoia of my own mind, but a real social danger visible in the face of every cop, every boss, everybody. Before the professor could state the obvious that not all Americans are racists, Black America's foremost essayist and public intellectual delivered a devastating soliloquy. "I don't know what most white people in this country feel, but I can only conclude what they feel from the state of their institutions. I don't know if white Christians hate Negroes or not, but I know we have a Christian church that is white and a Christian church that is Black. I know, as Malcolm X once put it, the most segregated hour in American life is high noon on Sunday. That says a great deal to me about a Christian nation. It means I can't afford to trust most white Christians. I certainly cannot trust the Christian church. I don't know whether the labor unions and their bosses really hate me. That doesn't matter. But I know I'm not in their union. I don't know whether the real estate lobby has anything against Black people, but I know the real estate lobby is keeping me in the ghetto. I don't know if the Board of Education hates Black people, but I know the textbooks they give my children to read and the schools we have to go to. Now this is the evidence. You want me to make an act of faith, risking myself, my wife, my woman, my sister, my children, on some idealism which you assure me exists in America, which I have never seen."
So why must we always concentrate on color? I can only imagine what James Baldwin was thinking and feeling when he heard the learned professor's question over 40 years ago on the Dick Cavett Show. But his response was powerful. Jim channeled that well. Last week, we considered Charles Feltman's description of trust as choosing to risk making something you value vulnerable to another person's actions. Risking something you value by making it vulnerable. That is trust. And this week, we're considering those in our country who may have little reason to trust the larger society, namely people of color, and how we might begin to build trust. So when James Baldwin said, "You want me to make an act of faith, risking myself, my wife, my woman, my sister, my children, on some idealism which you assure me exists in America, which I have never seen," he made explicit why he could not trust America. He didn't see evidence of that idealism. He wouldn't risk what he valued. But that was over 40 years ago. So much has changed since then, hasn't it? James Baldwin has been on my mind this week. We saw the movie version of his novel, If Beale Street Could Talk, at the Lyric. Have you seen it? Yeah. It, too, was powerful and heart-wrenching. Set in the early 70s, it's the story of two young people in love, starting their lives together, but confronted and stymied by racism and a corrupt criminal justice system. And the film's message and emotional effect on me was magnified by the story that I had heard the night before at the community conversation with an Innocence Project exoneree, part of Virginia Tech's observance of Black History Month. The Innocence Project's mission is to free the staggering number of innocent, incarcerated people in the U.S. and to reform our criminal justice system. Now, one of the project's lawyers told the story of Daryl Howard, a man who spent 24 years in prison for double murder and arson, crimes he did not commit. The lawyer asked the audience, "How many were younger than 24? And most of them were. It was their lifetime. He was exonerated through the efforts of the Innocence Project using DNA evidence that cleared him and implicated the likely murderer, who is still free. Mr. Howard and his wife, Nanny, sat next to the lawyer as she detailed the crime and the actions of the Durham, North Carolina District Attorney, Mike Nifong, who prosecuted the case. Listening to the story was frustrating. The police didn't follow a lead that could have led to the actual murderer. And Howard was convicted despite the lack of physical evidence, on the testimony of witnesses who had been threatened by the police if they didn't testify. It was frustrating because once DNA evidence cleared Howard, the state appealed, and he had to stay in prison until they lost their appeal. It was frustrating because of the unfairness and the blatant disregard for true justice. But hearing it, knowing that the man in front of us had lost 24 years of his life, made it all the more painful. Mr. Howard cried, and when he got up to speak, he apologized for his tears. So when I watched the movie about a young man accused of a crime he didn't commit and his young wife's efforts to free him, I had in my mind the real life love story of the Howards. Nanny Howard visited her husband every week for 24 years as he sat in prison for a crime he did not commit. Except 1 week. He said that he still gives her a hard time about that 1 week. But talk about love and commitment. Talk about trust. Mr. Howard was released in 2016, 3 years ago. Now, we're fortunate that Virginia Tech has created so many opportunities for us to hear the stories and experiences of African Americans, both for Martin Luther King Day and now for Black History Month. As a white person who has begun to understand racism relatively late in my life, and mostly from reading books and watching movies, it's been especially helpful to get a sense of what the racism endemic in our society has done and continues to do to other people. There's something about hearing someone's story in their own voice that goes through the mind and into the heart. So, why must we always concentrate on color? As I prepared for today's service, I was mindful that this is a question that might be on some of your minds. It seems like we've been talking about racism quite a bit lately. On Martin Luther King Sunday, we explored what it means to sing spirituals and the Black National Anthem with intention. And last week, we considered whether or how our elected officials could regain our trust, given the revelation that both our governor and attorney general had worn blackface as young men. One person was brave enough to tell me that they were just plain tired of the news and they didn't want to hear about it on Sunday morning. I get that. But as one late night comedian put it, if we're tired of talking about racism, imagine how tiring it must be living it every single day. We have been dealing with racism in this country for a very long time. This year marks the 400th since the first Africans were forcibly brought to this continent. You may have heard Governor Northam say that they came here as indentured servants, which the reporter quickly corrected by saying that, in fact, they were enslaved. Well, this seemed to be just another instance of the governor trying to apologize, but just making it worse. An editorial in the Roanoke Times this week explained why Northam might have used such language. He might have learned it from the official state textbook that was in use from 1957 into the 1970s, which was described in the editorial as little more than state-sponsored propaganda designed to brainwash Virginia students about the state's history in general and racial matters in particular. It goes on to say, in the late 1940s, the state's political establishment became concerned about the nascent civil rights movement. In response, the state, in 1950, created the Virginia History and Government Textbook Commission to design three history textbooks. Those books set out to inculcate students with what the commission chairman called the Virginia spirit, which basically meant to minimize slavery, glorify the Confederate cause, and discount any notions of racial equality. Some portions of the books were slanted at best, other parts were simply outright lies. So, does anyone want to out themselves and let us know if you were taught using those textbooks? No wonder some people object to taking down statues of Confederate generals. It goes against what they were taught. As James Comey explained in his editorial in the Washington Post, those monuments were put up as a message. The Confederate statues were put up by white people, he writes, beginning in the 1890s. To remind Black people that despite all that nonsense of Presidents Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant, as well as the so-called Reconstruction, we are back. White people are back, and you are back down. Comey writes, the towering likenesses of Robert E. Lee, Jefferson Davis, and Stonewall Jackson weren't put up to celebrate history or heritage. They were put up as a message. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution aren't going to help you black folks because the South has risen from that humiliation. Jim Crow, a name rooted in blackface mockery, is king. If you haven't seen the editorial, look it up. Because he talks about how General Longstreet, a venerated Confederate general, doesn't have statues in his honor. Because after the war, he worked to uplift black people. It's not about honor, people. It's about hate. So if we are to build trust, we might begin by learning and understanding the history of racism in this country. Crystal Fleming speaks to this need in an article titled, "Why Are We Talking About White Supremacy?" in the winter 2018 edition of our denominational magazine, The UU World, saying that most of us learned very little about the history and current realities of racism in school. If anything, you were likely taught that racism, while unfortunate, is mainly a thing of the past. In the essay adapted from her book, How to Be Less Stupid About Race, I haven't read the book, but I think I'm tempted now. Fleming admits to her own misunderstanding of race until being introduced to critical race theory. And she's got a PhD. She studied race. And she's African American. I encourage you to read the essay, especially if the term white supremacy has been difficult for you to take. A big takeaway for me is the idea that racism is less about individual attitudes and behaviors and more about systems of oppression. Fleming explains that it's important that we grasp how racism becomes institutionalized in the ideas and routine practices of our social organizations, our families, our laws and policies, our educational system, and the representation of race we absorb from the media. From mass incarceration to sentencing laws to racial discrimination in housing and home loans, the invisibility of institutional racism is maintained by the fact that it is literally hard to see. It's easy to spot racism when it comes in the form of a white hooded robe or a Confederate flag. It's more difficult when it is the much larger but less visible systems in our society that privilege white people. Things like wealth accumulation, home ownership, access to education. Unless it's happening to you. So if we are to build trust, we might begin by learning to recognize institutionalized racism. A clear example of institutionalized racism is the criminal justice system. Michelle Alexander, in The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, explains how this system was created and how, by targeting black men through the war on drugs and decimating communities of color, the U.S. criminal justice system functions as a contemporary system of racial control. The film If Beale Street Could Talk is a poignant depiction of that system. And during the Innocence Project community conversation, Daryl Howard, who was a victim of the criminal justice system, implored the audience of mostly students to do what they can to change the laws that led to the injustices done to him. I think of laws that prevent exculpatory evidence from being presented because of some arbitrary deadline being missed. When a person's life and liberty is at stake, how can a bureaucratic timeline be more important than justice? So if we are to build trust, we might begin by not just learning to recognize institutionalized racism, but to challenge it and dismantle it. So I struggled with what I could say today. I was telling someone, some sermons are easy to write, they just flow. This was not one of those sermons. I want to give some sense of hope that we can build trust with African Americans who have little reason to trust this nation, given its history of slavery and Jim Crow laws, and despite gains made during the Civil Rights era, continuing racial discrimination. I didn't want to spend all my time describing all the reasons why they might not trust, and took it on faith that you all would agree with my assumption. I don't know. I didn't want to spend all my time lecturing on institutionalized racism and systems of oppression, in part because I didn't want to lecture. I'm sure you'll let me know if I did. But also because it took hours of participation in workshops for me to begin to understand what that means. The anti-racism group that meets here has been grappling with these issues for nearly 2 years. They offered a workshop on pledging to end racism. And they're still going. Learning about systemic racism and how we might dismantle it is an ongoing process that never ends. You can't take apart something that's been around for hundreds of years in a day. Most of all, I don't want to give the impression that we all should feel guilty for our complicity with a white supremacist society. I didn't want to leave you feeling defensive and despairing. I attended way too many diversity trainings as a teacher where that was the end result. As one of my colleagues whispered at the start of one such workshop, oh, this is another one of those times when they're going to try to make me feel guilty for being white. I don't want us to feel guilty, not because we aren't complicit with a white supremacist society, because we are, all of us, but because feeling guilty or defensive is counterproductive. It doesn't do anything to end racism or to build trust. What I do want to leave us with is an understanding that racism is real, it is systemic, and we are all caught up in it. If you've ever heard Cornel West talk about it, he'll say, if I have been so impacted by white supremacy, then you all surely have. He said it just the other week on CNN. I want to leave us with the understanding that whatever we learned about the history of race in this nation was filtered through a lens that was meant to soften or excuse the abuses of the past. And in Virginia, that filter was very deliberate. But we do have the opportunity to gain a new understanding of racism. One that doesn't depend so much on racist individuals, though Lord knows there are plenty of those folks running around, but more insidiously and invisibly on systems that privilege white people and oppress people of color. All we have to do is turn on the news to see some of the causes and effects of such systems of oppression. What I want to leave us with is not a sense of guilt so much as a sense of responsibility. The responsibility to learn what we can about how our systems, legal, political, educational, and judicial, among others, maintain racism. And then the responsibility to do something about it. That could be pressing our legislators to enact even more criminal justice reform. Now that Congress has taken the first baby steps by passing the First Step Act, a landmark bill which would reduce drug crime sentences. It could be learning about the school-to-prison pipeline and seeing how it is playing out in our local school system, and then pressing school board members to make changes. Virginia Organizing will be holding a community forum on March 2nd to discuss the issue. It could be fighting against voter suppression, including the restoration of voting rights to felons. They did it in Florida, of all places, people. Or making Election Day a federal holiday to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to vote. It could be joining the Unitarian Universalist Worthy Now Prison Ministry Network by becoming a pen pal to an incarcerated person, making a personal connection to someone caught up in the system. After hearing Daryl Howard's plea that if we know someone who's in prison, we should reach out to them, I applied to the program. They asked for a 6-month commitment to write once a month to a UU who is incarcerated, and the letters go through their office. I'd be happy to share the website. And it took about 10 minutes to sign up. I encourage you to take advantage of some of the offerings at Virginia Tech for the rest of Black History Month. There are plenty of lectures and films and exhibits to choose from. I encourage you to read books, watch movies, listen to podcasts. Once you start looking for information on systemic racism, you'll find plenty of sources. We have been dealing with racism in this country for a very long time, and we've been making progress, but we have a long way to go. It's important to acknowledge that, as Ibram X. Kendi observes, our nation's emphasis on racial progress has obscured racist progress, the evolution of racist ideas and practices alongside anti-racist transformations. The news can be depressing, and we can feel overwhelmed. But we can find hope in doing what we can to learn and to act, to do our part in building trust.